Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Psalms chapter 25. We'll call this psalm, Teach Me Your Paths. The heading of the psalm is very simple. It says, of David. So this, once again, is a Davidic psalm. Psalms 2 through 25 so far have all been written by David. Not number 1, but 2 through 25. So we start now in verses 1 through 3. David says this to the Lord. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I trust. Do not let me be ashamed. Do not let my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none of those who wait for you will be ashamed. Those who deal treacherously without cause will be ashamed. Now David says to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. A couple of options on what soul means there. It could be David's inner man, as in his spirit, the non-corporeal part of his person. Here's some scriptures that use soul in that way. Lamentations 3:41, we lift up our heart. Heart is the same thing as soul, the immaterial part of man. We lift up our heart and hands toward God. Psalm 31:5, into your hand I commit my spirit, the immaterial part of man. Psalm 86:4, make glad the soul of your servant. For to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. So it could be that, but it also could be David's whole person. O Lord, I lift up my whole person to you. Let me read you a quote about the meaning of the word soul in Hebrew. This is from pursuegod.org, a website. Quote, in English, the soul usually refers to the non-material part of us that survives after death. But the Hebrew concept of soul is best understood as the whole person, the essence of who we are. So I like to take verse 1 this way. David is saying, God, I'm lifting up my whole person to you. Everything is yours. My body as well as my spirit. Verse 2, O my God, in you I trust, do not let me be ashamed. Now how is David going to be ashamed? Well, the next part of verse 2 tells us when David says, do not let my enemies exult over me. That's how you get ashamed when you get beat by an enemy. That's pretty shameful. David doesn't want to get beat by his enemies. Now, of course, this is probably the number one theme in his Psalms, at least so far. Over and over again, he talks about he's surrounded by enemies. Don't let them beat me, Lord. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says David would be ashamed by, quote, disappointment of hopes of relief, relief from his enemies. Verse 3, David continues, indeed, none of those who wait for you will be ashamed. And that word wait has a very common English meaning, and we miss the nuance of it in the original language. It doesn't just mean to wait like you're waiting at a train station. It means to wait with confident expectation. Let me give you a good quote from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, ISBE. Quote, the most important and frequent use of the word wait, however, is to define the attitude of a soul Godward. It implies the listening ear, a heart responsive to the wing of God, a concentration of the spiritual faculties upon heavenly things, the patience of faith, the earnest expectation of the creation. It describes an eager anticipation and yearning for the revelation of truth and love as it is in the Father. Now that is a bodacious definition of wait. So it doesn't just mean sitting around passively waiting for God to do something good for you, to deliver you from your troubles. It means you are focused on Him and you are confidently expecting Him to deliver you. And then David finishes up verse 3 by saying, those who deal treacherously without cause will be ashamed. He contrasts. He says, if you wait on God, you won't be ashamed. But if you deal treacherously without reason, you will be ashamed. In other words, his enemies will be beaten. David continues verses 4 through 7. Make me know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day. So we see here this psalm is mainly a psalm about guidance, which of course is a huge theme for Christians wanting to know the will of God. And so David is just like us. He wants to know the will of God for his life. He says, for you are the God of my salvation. Salvation means deliverance. He's not really talking about eternal deliverance here. I'm sure he's talking about temporal deliverance from his enemies. And he says, for you I wait with confident expectation, focused only on the Lord. I wait for you all the day. I'm waiting for you to deliver me, God. Verse 6. David says, remember, O Lord, your compassion and your loving kindnesses, for they have been from of old. Do not remember the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your loving kindness, remember me for your goodness' sake, O Lord. Goodness' sake. See, God is a good God, even in the Old Testament. He's not just a God of wrath throwing thunderbolts at people just because he's a sadist. He's a God of loving kindness and goodness. Now in verse 6, David says, "Remember, O Lord, your compassion." Why would David ask God to remember anything? After all, God is omniscient. God doesn't remember the way we do. He doesn't reach back into his memory. He knows everything instantly, past, present, and future. Well, the answer to this is in the definition of remember. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says. Remember is a strong covenant word. Asking God to remember does not imply that he has forgotten. It is asking God to act now on the basis of his promises. For example, we say, "Remember me in your will." That means to do something for me. So there's two definitions of remember. One is to call to mind, and the other is to do something for me. So when David says, "Remember, O Lord, your compassion," he's saying, "Do something for me according to your compassion and your loving kindnesses." Compassion, loving kindness. Once again, is God just a vengeful, wrathful God in the Old Testament? I don't think so. Now, David must have had a twinge of conscience here. In verse 7, he says, "Do not remember the sins of my youth." Why would he distinguish the sins of his youth compared to the sins of his adulthood? Well, young people tend to sin more. Young people haven't had the benefit of years. Years of chastisement. Years of getting close to God and learning about what is holy and what is not. I think of the things that I did. I almost ended up in jail one time. I almost ruined my life. I think of all the stupid things I did. Stupid. Beyond belief stupid. Young and dumb. And I've watched young people since then, even the wisest of young people, they make bad decisions based upon unsanctified desires, being trapped by the world, and then they get beat over the head with God's chastisement because the world doesn't give them the happiness that they want, and then they say, "Well, you know, I need to reexamine my attitudes, my goals, my heart's desire," and then they get straight with the Lord, and all of a sudden God starts blessing them. Well, that takes a while. So David is talking about the sins of his youth. He says, "Don't remember me according to the sins of my youth." Now, how might God remember the sins of his youth? Is David worried that God is going to bring the sins of his youth to mind, and then God is going to take action on them and punish them? That's probably what David was worried about. John Gill says that David was not trying to extenuate the sins of his youth. He was not trying to brush off the sins of his youth as sowing wild oats. He's just bringing out the fact that he sinned a lot when he was young. Now, of course, David had some whopping big sins when he was an adult. Committed adultery with Bathsheba and then killed Uriah, murdered him. Now, these transgressions could have happened after the psalm was written, of course. But at any rate, David confesses he's a sinner. Now, we need to remember these verses when we consider the problem of David's self-righteousness in the Psalms, as I talked about in audio number 1 in this series on the Psalms. David a lot of times says, "Lord, I am blameless, I am righteous." And so it sounds like he's bragging, like he's braggadocious. Well, we need to balance those verses off with these verses where David says he's a sinner. Now, what David means when he says he's righteous, he means he's righteous in a particular area. He hasn't done something that would cause him to be guilty, just like Job used the term. He was using righteous in a relative sense, not an absolute sense. He was not saying he was righteous like Adam and Eve were before they ate the fruit in the garden. We go now to Psalms 25, 8 through 11. David continues. He's switching to the third person. He was talking to God, now he's talking to the reader. "Good and upright is the Lord," and he does that all the time in his Psalms. "Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in justice, and he teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are loving kindness and truth to those who keep his covenant and his testimonies." There's that nasty Old Testament Yahweh. Loving kindness. "For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my iniquity, for it is great." Now David in verse 8 says that God instructs sinners in the way. Now, of course, the theme of this psalm is knowing God's will. Teach me your paths. And David says, yes, God instructs me. He instructs sinners. He's referring to himself. There's no self-righteousness here. For all of us who may be concerned about David being too cocky and bragging about his self-righteousness, as I said earlier. In verse 9, David says that God leads the humble in justice. So notice that one of the requirements for guidance from God is humility. God teaches the humble his way, David says at the end of verse 9. Verse 10, "All the paths of the Lord are loving kindness and truth to those who keep his covenant." So notice that if you want to know the path of the Lord, you have to obey. You have to keep his covenant. And that covenant most likely was the law of Moses, as the NIV Study Bible says, not the Abrahamic covenant. So be obedient. Don't go out and violate the Ten Commandments if you want to know the paths of the Lord. Verse 11, for your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my iniquity, for it is great. Notice that David is not only concerned about him being free from sin, pardoned from iniquity, but also for God's sake. God's character and reputation are wrapped up in his name, so when David says your name's sake, he's talking about God's character, his public reputation. To forgive God's people is to reflect favorably upon God's character and reputation. So David says, forgive me for my sins, for your sake as well as mine. Psalms 9:10 says this, and those who know your name will put their trust in you, for you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. So whenever you see that phrase, the name of God, it's talking about not just letters on a page, not just a handle. It's talking about the essence of the person, including all of his attributes. And then David finishes off verse 11 by saying, pardon my iniquity, God, for it, my iniquity, is great. He's a great sinner. He sins greatly. No self-righteousness there. For all of us who were worried about David's self-righteousness in other psalms, we go now to Psalms 25, verses 12 through 15. David continues, who is the man who fears the Lord? The Lord will instruct him in the way this man should go, in the way he should choose. His soul will abide in prosperity, and his descendants will inherit the land. The secret of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he will make them know his covenant. My eyes are continually toward the Lord, for he will pluck my feet out of the net. That's a hunter's net. David's saying, I'm not going to get caught by my enemies who are hunting me. In verse 12, David says, who is the man who fears the Lord? That word fears, of course, means reverence. It's not referring to being in terror of God. It just means, who is the man who treats the Lord with reverence? If you do that, God will instruct him in the way that he should choose. Now, here is a question. How much of our lives does God plan for us? Let me give you four options. Option number one, God makes all the decisions and we humans have no choices to make. Well, that's obviously not true. We have to make choices. Option number two, we make all the decisions and God is never consulted. Well, for Christians or followers of Yahweh in the Old Testament, that's obviously not true. We're going to decide everything and not ever consult God. Well, then you'll end up screwed up just like all non-Christians you know. And if you don't believe that people are screwed up, read the internet. Watch the movies, read the novels, and people will tell you about screwed up lives. I don't care how rich people are. In fact, the more famous and rich they are, the more screwed up their lives are. So that's not true. So those two options we can knock out. Now here's option number three. We choose all the options that we might do. And of course, the two classic questions are, what job do I take and what man or woman should I marry? So here's option three. We choose all the options and ask God to bless which options we choose. Now, this is what I call the Gary Friesen thesis. He wrote a book. It's been published in five languages. It's been enormously influential. I don't know what I think about it. It's on my theological do list. I just read a blog by Tim Challies reviewing five Find the Will of God books, books about God's guidance. One of them was by Kevin DeYoung, a very famous RTS professor, and they all adopt the Friesen thesis that, oh, well, just pick out five women. Ooh, she'd be good. Let me chase them. I'll go one after the other. Get shot down, get rejected, have my heart broken. Oh, but this one just works out great. Now, that's option three. Here's option four. This is what I call the Blackaby option because this Southern Baptist guy named Blackaby has got a book out on guidance. My wife actually went through it. And it's very, very popular. And the NIV Study Bible goes along with this view, which is that God has the best way for us to go, and we need to ask him to show us what his will is. Now, that's the traditional view of guidance, and Friesen tries to blow that up. So we need to ask God to show us which way to go. Well, in verse 12, David says, God will instruct the man who fears the Lord in the way that he should choose. Well, that sounds like Blackaby and the NIV Study Bible are correct here, that there is one way that David should go, there is one way that David should choose, and God will show him that one way, the best way. But the KJV translates verse 12 this way, God will instruct the man who fears the Lord in the way he shall choose. Now, that makes the Friesen thesis sound true because the The human being is making the choices which way he shall go, and then God will instruct him in that way that he chose. Oh, you want to marry Susie Q instead of Diane? Well, marry Susie Q. God will help you with that. Whew. I'll be honest with you. I have a hard time with that, but apparently I have now become somewhat in the minority view. Apparently, this is on my theological bucket list. My theological do list is to explore Mr. Friesen's thesis that we just do what we want to do as long as it's moral, as long as Susie Q and Diane and Mary and Jane are all dedicated Christians following the Lord, we'll go after all of them. It doesn't matter. Aye, that's not the way I've lived my life. I always figured that God knows best what I should do, and he knows better than me. How about God? Show it to me. Well, at any rate, we'll abstract away from the mechanics of how God instructs us, and we will just state the fact that God will instruct the man who fears the Lord. Verse 12. Verse 13. This man's soul will abide in prosperity. And of course, soul means not just his immaterial part of him, but his whole person. He will abide in prosperity. And because the prosperity message has screwed up the word prosperity, we need to point out, as always, that prosperity does not merely mean financial prosperity, but it means success. I mean, the Apostle Paul wasn't rich, but he was successful, and financially he had the money when he needed it. But he wasn't living in a $23 million house like Kenneth Copeland and Benny Hinn and Creflo Dollar. Now, let's use the proper definition of prosperity, which means success, flourishing, and so forth, and ask another question. Does godliness always lead to prosperity? Well, in general, it does, but not always. I mean, think about Job. He was a godly man. How prosperous was he in the middle of his trials? There are individual cases where very godly people are poor. A life that is prosperous in general might have periods of no prosperity. Consider Job's life. He was a wealthy man at the beginning of the book, and at the end of the book, he was a wealthy man, which shows there's nothing wrong with being prosperous financially. There's nothing wrong with being rich. But in the middle of his life, ooh boy, he lost it all. Prosperity means having your needs taken care of by God. Prosperity does not mean the amount of assets one has on one's balance sheet. Consider the life of Paul the Apostle, as I just mentioned. How financially rich was he? How about Jesus? Oh, yeah. The birds had nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. That's really prosperous, isn't it? That's really financially prosperous. Where's this $23 million mansion? What kind of a son of God is this that can't even live in a mansion? He must not have made all the positive confessions that he should have done. He must not have marked his wealth and parked it. He must not have blabbed it and grabbed it. He must not have screamed it and redeemed it. He must not have confessed it and possessed it. David says at the end of verse 13 that the man who fears the Lord will have descendants who will inherit the land. That land there can be translated as earth. And in fact, the King James translates it as earth. So does the Holman Christian Study Bible, in the note at least. In the marginal note, translates it as earth. Jameson Fawcett Brown says it should be land. The phrase alluding to the promise of Canaan expresses all the blessings included in that promise, temporal as well as spiritual. So when Abraham was promised land, offspring, and blessing, I'm sure that's what David's thinking about here. Land, offspring, land, descendants. His descendants will inherit the land that was promised to Abraham is what David's referring to here. He's not talking about the whole earth, in my humble opinion. Verse 14, David says, the secret of the Lord is for those who fear him. Now, here's some other translations of that. The NIV says, the Lord confides in those who fear him. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, the secret counsel of the Lord is for those who fear him. And he reveals his covenant to him. The NIV Study Bible says, this metaphor pictures an intimate communion with God, as though mere humans could sit in on God's heavenly counsel. God's love for people causes him to long for fellowship with him. So once again, the idea, if you want to know God, you want to know his covenant, you want to know his secrets, his secret counsel, the secret of the Lord is for those who fear him, those who reverence him, and that way you'll get to know the secret things of God. Think about this. God is not going to reveal everything to the baby Christian. He couldn't handle it. Plus, he wants to teach the baby Christian to walk in faith. But the more that baby Christian learns to love God, and to learn the secrets of his ways, the more God will reveal to him. To him who has much, much is given. Jesus said that in the New Testament, and it's really true. So we see that fearing God or having reverence for God is a prerequisite for knowing God's covenant. which could be Abrahamic covenant. After all, land in the sentence we just talked about, NIV Study Bible thinks it's the Mosaic covenant, but whichever. So we see that reverence for God is a prerequisite here in verse 14 for knowing God's will, for knowing his counsel. Well, let me summarize three requirements in verses 9, 10, and 14. Three requirements to know the will of God. First of all, the first requirement is humility in verse 9, which reads this way, God leads the humble in what is right in teaching them his way. He leads those who are humble. The implication is he doesn't lead those who are proud. The second requirement to know the secret counsels of God is obedience. This is in verse 10. All the Lord's ways show faithful love and truth to those who keep his covenant and decrees. You keep his commands obediently. So obedience is the second requirement to know God's will, the secrets of his counsel. And then reverence is the third requirement to know God's will. Psalms 25:14, the secret counsel of the Lord is for those who fear him, who reverence him, and he reveals his covenant to them. So humility, obedience, and reverence. Humility, obedience, and reverence. You want to know what God wants for your life? Humility, obedience, and reverence. We go now to Psalms 25, verses 16 through 22, and we will finish this audio. David continues, speaking to God, "Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Look upon my affliction and my trouble, and forgive all my sins. Look upon my enemies, for there are many, and they hate me with violent hatred. Guard my soul and deliver me. Do not let me be ashamed, for I take refuge in you. Let integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles." Now notice in verse 16, David says, "I am lonely and afflicted." He's a king. He's lonely as a king? Well, he couldn't trust in anybody, especially after Absalom's rebellion, as John Gill points out. His own son started a civil war, ran him out of town. It's lonely at the top. This is a common theme. Presidents are lonely people. Everybody's giving the president a bunch of sycophantic advice, sucking up to him, but not really being close to him. And then as soon as he loses power, they turn on him like vultures. It's lonely at the top. David asks for grace from God. "Be gracious to me. I need grace. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses." He says the same thing in Psalms 18, verse 48. "God delivers me from my enemies. Surely you lift me above those who rise up against me. You rescue me from the violent man." David is always talking about his enemies, but he also constantly talks about how God's going to deliver him out of the attacks of his enemies. He doesn't say that God will do that here in verse 17. He prays that it would happen. "Bring me out of my distresses. Look upon my affliction and my trouble and forgive all my sins." Again, David, I really think that when you're in trouble, you do kind of tend to be more aware of your sins. You're thinking, well, maybe I did something to cause all this evil to come on my head. I mean, David could have been thinking of Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite. And of course, that sin eventually led to the rebellion of Absalom. We don't know when the psalm was written, but it could be. And again, does David sound very self-righteous here? No. He sounds very, very penitent. "Forgive all my sins." Verse 19, David says, "Look upon my enemies, for there are many." And of course, that's one of the major themes in David's Psalms. I've got enemies, God, help me. "There are many, they hate me with a violent hatred." Verse 20, "Guard my soul and deliver me. Do not let me be ashamed." So David ends the Psalm here in verse 20 in the same way that he began the Psalm in verse 2. "O my God, in you I trust. Do not let me be ashamed." And again, it doesn't mean to have your face turn red. It means to get beaten, which of course would cause you much terrible shame. "Don't let me be beaten," is what he's saying, "for I take refuge in you." Verse 21, "Let integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you." Now, whose integrity is this referring to? It could refer to God's integrity, as some people say. "Let your faithfulness to the covenant preserve me." Or it could be, "Let David's integrity and uprightness preserve me." In other words, David is saying, I'm going to try to keep following you. I'm going to try to be humble. I'm going to try to be obedient. I'm going to try to be reverent. And my integrity and uprightness will preserve me. And again, that's not saying he's sinlessly perfect. He's just saying, I'm doing the best I can. It's a relative righteousness. If integrity is referring to David's integrity and not God's integrity. And he says, I wait for you. Again, that's I wait with confident expectation with my whole soul focused on you, God. Deliver me. David says in verse 22, redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. Notice that David here is not only praying for himself personally, he's always conscious that he is head of the nation of Israel. He is a leader. He is a king. He's not just an individual. Redeem Israel out of your troubles. Redeem, of course, is a legal term. It means buying a slave or a debtor out of debt, out of bondage to debt, or out of personal bondage. Somebody's got to pay the person who has the rights over the slave, whether it be a creditor, whether it be a slave owner, whatever. The debtor or slave is redeemed, bought out. And, of course, that's a joyous thing. It happened every 7 years. They would cancel debts every 49 years, a year of jubilee. And so when you think redemption, that's a great thing. As we are redeemed for our sins, we're bought out of our bondage to slavery by Jesus' blood, and that's a joyous thing. We're redeemed out of all our troubles. Now notice that David does not take a Pollyanna approach to his life. He admits he has troubles. He constantly admits he has enemies and troubles and affliction, but he always has a positive attitude. God, you're going to get me out of this mess. He depended on God. He didn't go around saying, well, life is a bowl of cherries. I'm living in a rose garden. No, he knew life was tough. His life was very difficult. But he constantly prayed to God to deliver him from all of his troubles. And on that positive note, we are finished with Psalms 25. We are prepared now in our next audio to go. We are prepared now in our next audio to go to Psalms 26, verses 1 through 12, which we will entitle, I Will Bless the Lord. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.